Welcome to class. Before we dive in, any comments, questions, concerns, other things for me? Yes?
Does UVA do any graphics research?
Does UVA, the CS department does not. We have, in the time I have been here, we have had three different graphics researchers. All have come, all have gone. Yes?
For the homework assignments, resubmitting,
yeah.
Is there a deadline for that, end of classes?
Yeah, I have to submit grades eventually.
But could it be after classes end, but before the final?
There used to be a policy that I wasn't allowed to accept assignments after the end of classes. I don't know if that policy is still around. I don't know. Yeah?
I don't think that policy is still around. I have a class that I'm turning in something for last today.
Yeah, people never followed it.
That's
yeah. It turns out that the policies that exist and the policies that get followed have always been not disjoint sets, but not strong overlap. Yeah. There's also sort of policies that people say exist that, as far as I can tell, never, ever, ever have. Like all of the various I have too many exams in a row versions that exist. The college has a version of this that's way more restrictive than everybody assumes, and the School of Engineering, as far as I can tell, has never had such a policy. And yet everybody has heard of one. Right? Who knew, right? Anyway. Other thoughts, comments, questions? Yes?
Do you like graphics, or is it just something you know about?
Do I like graphics, or is it just something I know about? I genuinely enjoy graphics algorithms. My impression about enjoying as a consumer of graphics has changed over the years. I'm just not very impressed anymore. I don't know. I guess I'm getting a callous, jaded old man. Yeah. No, I genuinely enjoy graphics research, and I probably would have done graphics for my PhD if I had found a graphics researcher that I wanted to work with. This is a note for all of you going to grad school. It is more important to work with a nice person than a smart person. And it's more important to work in an area where your boss is nice to you than in an area where you're excited by your results. If you can get them all, great, right? But the people can make your life miserable, and the work can't. Anyway. But yeah, I came here and I didn't personally get on with our graphics researchers that were here at the time, but I did get on with somebody else, so I switched what I did with my life. Yeah?
I saw a trailer for this movie where they took black and white footage from the World War II and converted to color. How did they do that?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. I don't know how that one did it, but I know the principle, so let's talk about the principle. All right. So how do you go from black and white to color? Let's start with the simplest way, which is with a paintbrush. So it turns out that we have various color spaces, right? And in particular, we have HSL, where the L is lightness, a range from white to black. Okay? And so if we think about black and white, we can say it has... You actually need a slightly different color model for most old film because it turns out that red often looked blackish. Anyway, but you have some version of HSL for some definition of saturation where we have the L channel. And so what we need to do is supply the remaining channels, H and S. Okay? And in principle, that's all we have to do. So you can essentially give somebody a brush where they pick a particular H and S and then they paint. For actual physical paints, there is even techniques approached where you could paint on the back of a film where your pressure would give you the saturation, so you just have to pick the hue, right? Anyway, there's various tricks to do this. If you want to do it to a whole film, you may actually find it easier to pay people to do it. But there's various tricks you can use as well. So when we think about film compression, how do we compress digital film? I know we talked about compression of images. I don't remember if we talked about compression of animation. Yeah?
Don't you generally,
store one frame as an image at some point and then store deltas of like how it changes over a short period of time?
Yeah, we tend to have deltas. We tend to have, in particular, we tend to have what's called image flow or image space flow. How does this region of the image move? Okay. This is very useful if we're having somebody color something. They can color just a few frames, and we can sort of use the flow to flow those channels of color around for us. Even better than that, we can look at the region that is moving together, and that is generally some object. It is likely to have a similar hue and saturation. The lightness often changes a lot, because that's caused by difference of lighting. But hue and saturation are not generally, unless there's brightly colored lights in the scene, they generally are uniform across the lit area. So if I can find the part of the scene that's moving and color it all with one hue and saturation, this will be a reasonable baseline. Okay? We can also do various kinds of edge detection, which is in homework 5, but I realize we haven't actually talked about how anything in homework 5 works, have we? Isn't that exciting? Wonder if we should spend some time doing that now. First I'll talk about how this works for film, right? So I have some image, right, that has some being floating out here, and there's, I don't know, some tree behind them or something, and I want to make the being have some variant of flesh tone and the tree have some variant of tree tone. And most of the areas here, I will have a nice, crisp boundary. Now, there's often, if we look at the edges, little gaps, little areas where it's the same color as the thing behind. And so we can actually make a user interface that when you say, I don't know, maybe we're going to say this is a green-skinned individual, if we say that spot is green, we can sort of assume that you, or we do some sort of like little squish like this, like, okay, you're saying all of this region. I'm not really sure what to do at the boundary, so I'll leave that open until you wiggle down there, right? And so we can essentially allow them to just give a few rapid strokes that says this is a region I'm interested in, use some combination of edge detection, similar flow, to assume we know the boundary and make it much, much faster for them to color inside the lines. And so you could do these sorts of things. There, you could go beyond this. Okay? You could take, here is a film that's all black and white, here is a reference film of color, and we will throw it at the giant animal called machine learning and hope it can figure out what color to make everything. And this is the kind of task that machine learning could probably be trained pretty well for. It has sort of nicely behaved scenarios. You aren't likely to have outliers and things that will make it crash and so on. And we really do care about small detail, not big detail, which everything in computer is better locally than remotely. I don't know if they have made advances in that particular application of this. I do know, though, that they have things where you can, for example, have two films of two people both talking and take the mouth motions of one and repurpose it to the face of the other. And so on. A lot of this is actually used a lot in film when you decide to change the dialogue after you shot the scene. So there's a lot of techniques there, and I bet a lot of those would transfer over here to make it even easier. You just key a few things, give a few references, and it will fill in the rest. We should probably talk a little bit about, oh yes?
Another thing specific to the World War II thing, apparently they were shooting color film at that point, and then just they didn't have the chemical treatments.
Oh, they had the chemical film, so they just regained it.
Yeah, they just like vaulted away.
It's worth noting that film degrades, so they almost certainly had to do some digital post-production to make it look worth seeing. But yeah, they may have actually recorded it in color. That would certainly help, because if I just have black and white film, who is to say what color things were? Right? Is it just up to some artist, or do you have some references? Right? So, yeah. Other questions? How many of you want me to preview some stuff we should talk about for homework 5? Oh, that's more than half of you. All right. It's not on schedule, but let's do that. We haven't even mentioned this at all besides that it exists, have we? All right. Well, the idea here is image in, image out. All of your programs will be image in, image out with some operators to happen in between. Hopefully many of you have started already if you think you're going to do this. But there is some stuff here that is, none of these were I decided to be arbitrary and capricious. These are all things that the first version didn't have written down, and then we realized everybody that didn't figure these out was hating themselves. Okay? So we really do mean these. Use 01 color space. Really do use either OO design or separate channels. Preferably OO design, although I'm always amazed after multiple semesters of teaching OO how many of you will never actually design objects on your own. Okay? But I think you'll find your life much easier if you make a color object and a image object and so on. Anyway, we give you some math because a lot of things are defined multiple ways. I believe we looked at some of these equations a little bit when we introduced the different color models. But we have these different functions about the definition of how you get between different things. It's worth noting that hue is a mess. Hue is this piecewise linear function, except it really shouldn't even be piecewise linear. It should really be piecewise logistic or something. Anyway, but we are just doing the linear version of it because most people do. And then a piecewise linear function's inverse is messy anyway. But there's the math and turn it into code. And there's another explanation here, which has pictures and cool things like that, but they have a different S. Just know they have a different S, because there's like four or five different S's out there. So some of these, hopefully, will be pretty straightforward. You take an image, you just spit out one channel. Hooray, great. Equalize, you divide. Hooray, we can do that. And then let's talk about convolution, because I don't think we've mentioned convolution at all, have we? I assume some of you have bumped into this somewhere else, but I don't know how many of you. Let's just have a quick finger poll. Closed fist means I've never heard the word before. All five fingers means I could teach this part of the lecture. How comfortable are we with convolutions? All right, the entire gamut. Closed fists, fives, everything in between. All right, let's teach the basic idea of convolution. This is something that we totally probably should have covered, and I may even have had my schedule and forgot to do. Okay. The idea of a convolution, at least the version of it we will teach, there are other ways of posing this, but the idea of a convolution is we're going to take some raster, some grid of numbers. We typically think of them as being single channel at a time, so each of these cells will just have one number. I don't know, let's just put some random numbers here. Let's put, okay, I'm just going to put some numbers. And I don't feel like being creative, so I'm just going to put a bunch of ones into this. Great. So this is going to be my input image, and presumably there'd be numbers everywhere. We'll just assume all the ones that didn't fill in were zero because it would make my life easier. We're going to make another raster. Okay? In general, we might make it a little bit smaller or the same size. Each cell in the new raster is going to be based on a weighted average of cells in the original raster. So let's see if we can make this happen. All right, so here's my original, here's going to be my new. And what we need to know is how do we weight it average? So we need something we call a filter or a kernel. Kernel is used for way too many things in computing. Anyway, let's say we have a 3x1 kernel, okay? A typical convolution filter will have it will sum to 1 because we want to have an average. So let's say we have, I don't know, -1/2, 2, and then I need it to sum to 1, so I need another -1/2, right? Let's suppose this is my filter. For each pixel in the original image, I will center the filter on that pixel, add together its neighbors, and find its new value. So if I consider this pixel here, -1/2 times 0 plus 2 times 1 plus -1/2 times 1 is going to be 1.5. So I'll put 1 and 1/2 here. Okay? Just by averaging those things out. How about this pixel? This pixel, -1/2, 2, -1/2, all times 1, so that's just going to be 1. This pixel here, okay? I have -1/2, 2, -1. -1/2, 2, -1, that's going to be 1/2, right? And I just do this for every single pixel in the image. right? So if we want to think about a boring one, this pixel, everything around it is 0. 0 times negative 1/2, 0 times 2, 0 times 0, right? We end up with 0 here, right? So this is a way of doing some sort of special shaped average of the neighboring pixels. Question?
Is the filter always over a 2 by, like a...
Your filter could be any shape you want.
Okay.
It's almost always rectangular. You actually can define non-rectangular ones, but it can be any shape you want. Yes?
Do you have to normalize it all? Actually,
No. Well, I guess it depends on what you're doing. Okay, so in the homework assignment, we explicitly state do not clamp the channel values during processing, but do before saving. So if partway through you end up with a pixel value of 5, leave it. But if it's still 5 at the very end, then clamp it. Essentially, we're using a high dynamic range in the middle. Yes?
Should we treat any values outside of the actual image as 0? So like the first pixel in the image, you'll have values.
Yeah, so this creates a problem of boundary, okay? If we think about this example, so I'm gonna back up for, and you'll get to your question in a moment. If we think about this example, I have all of these cells. What should I do for this? Oh, let's put some numbers in it first. Let's suppose I have 1, 2, 1, 3, 5, 2, okay? What should I do for this cell? I know I've got 2 times 2, that's a 4. I've got a negative 1/2 times 5, so that's a negative 2.5. What do I do about the third piece?
You can 0.
I could 0 it, or?
It depends. So sometimes it'll take the other side of the image and you do it, or you'll copy that row over.
Right? So I could also wrap around. I could say, oh, there's a negative 3 over here, let's wrap it. Or?
You just use 2 again.
The one that will usually work best for the kind of image manipulations we're going to do is you just extend. You just take whatever was the boundary and keep it going. Okay? So I don't want, in general, if I pick 0, then I'm going to act like there is a boundary of black around everything. I don't want that. If I wrap it around, this will only work for wraparound pictures. And it'll give weird effects on the side. But if I just pretend like whatever was here, it just stays. That most of the convolutions will sort of do the right thing, do the intuitive thing. The boundary may lose some detail, but you won't see weird things. So this one, for example, we'll talk about how this convolution works. But we want all the way up to the edge. We don't want some sign that there was a boundary at the edge. You just want it to sort of fade nice and gradually off the edge. So what we typically do, the one we ask you to do in this assignment, is to just clamp. If you try to read a pixel off of the canvas, just find the nearest one that was on the canvas. And if you do good OO design, you could just make this be what your index operator or the like for your image does, and poof, your life just solves this problem without thinking. If you don't believe in OO, you have to add if statements. You know, this is how life goes. Okay, does this answer that was your question. Other questions about this idea so far? Okay, now it turns out that convolutions allow you to do strange things you wouldn't expect. The one you probably do expect is if you just make the filter sort of the same number everywhere, it blurs the image. Although that turns out not to be the kind of blur we usually like. But it does do it. But however, you can also use something like the Schar filter, this 3x3 filter. Don't forget the 1/16th in the front. This is an approximation of the gradient of the image. Okay, so you'll notice here that this one has positive above, negative below, which means that if the image is sort of constant in Y, if it's not changing vertically, we'll get a bunch of zeros. So the above and below will cancel each other out. But if on the other hand, the image is increasing in brightness going up, I'll get a positive number. If it's decreasing in brightness going up, I'll get a negative number. And I can do the same thing in the x-axis, and I can get a gradient of the image. There are other convolutions that do gradients. There's actually a surprisingly detailed and informative Wikipedia article that goes into why you care and has example images and so on about different ways of computing a gradient. But this one works pretty nicely. And yes, there is a reason why it's 3 and 10 and 3 and not 1, 1, 1. Anyway, we could go into all of that, but we won't. has something to do with making it separable. Anyway, but when you're done with that, you'll end up with a gradient. You'll end up with how much the image is pointing in different directions. This is required because it is key to doing everything else. So let's jump down to, how about edges? Okay, here is, we just take a picture of the globe, and all we've done here is found the magnitude of the gradient. If the gradient is zero, we make it white. If the gradient is a large number in any direction, we make it black. And poof, we get an outline of the continents with some gaps where the land looks sort of bluish, right? But we basically get a gradient. We also get some there's a boundary, like mountain ranges. Some things show up where the original image had some strong gradients. But we can get a fairly good edge detection out of that all by itself. We can also do things like sharpening, okay? The idea here is how do I describe this? This is actually many, many runs. That was not the button I wanted. There we are. We take a painting of Jefferson, and what we want to do is we want to make it crisper. So it's easiest to see is probably in the hair. We're basically saying, if this pixel is different from its neighbors, make it more different. Okay? And if it's the same as its neighbors, leave it alone. But try to accentuate the differences with the neighbors. So essentially we're going to multiply this pixel's brightness and then subtract it from all of its neighbors. So if its neighbors are brighter, it will get dimmer. If its neighbors are dimmer, it will get brighter. And we do this for each channel, and we can end up trying to really highlight the fact that the original wasn't smooth. So here is the sharpening matrix, the sharpening convolution filter that does that for you. Where you can come along and you can say, we're going to add more than the original value of the center pixel and a negative of all the ones around it. One other thing we should know is about separable filters. So there's this notion that some filters I can do as a row and a column separately, do the two, and it doesn't matter what order I did them in. So if I can do row then column or column then row and I end up at the same result, then the outer product of the two is a separable filter. And this is dramatically more efficient. Okay? So there is this particular one, if we look at the blur input, we ask to blur with a 101 pixel wide filter. Okay, if you were to try to do the full 101 pixels in each direction, for every single pixel in the image, you would be trying to sample 10,000 pixels. And so you'd end up having to do 10,000 samples for every single one, and it would be really slow. But instead, we can just do 100, and then 100, and instead of doing 10,000, we do 200, and our life is dramatically faster. And so a lot of these filters are actually designed based on a notion of trying to make this look like the product of some separable filter. There is various aspects in which separable filters sort of don't care about the axes, and so they don't show up boundaries. But I've just done all that because the first time I tried to do this and explain it, it didn't work real well. So we have just straight up modify the colors. You only need to think about individual pixels. We have convolutions, including this one where you say, give me an arbitrary convolution matrix and make it do what it does. And then you can go look at this and say, ooh, that's a weird looking moon. And yeah, it is, because you know we're like smearing the red, not the green, and anyway, right? We can blur things, we can sharpen them, we can find their edges. And then we have all the non-local stuff. So I'll get to the non-local stuff in a moment. Any questions about the convolution and the per pixel stuff? Yeah?
How close should your gray TJ look to the 100?
I have left no ambiguities in the spec. So you should be able to get exact copies of the pictures. So the gray TJ, you're talking about the gradient, this one, yes?
Yeah.
All right, there's an ambiguity in the spec. It isn't really an ambiguity, right? But is this small y, big Y, or top Y, bottom Y? Those are different things because pixels, right? Y goes down. So most people I've had that says, this looks like something like it, but all of my colors are wrong. They're like, flip your Y. I've seen a few where they do Y and X backwards. But most commonly, just flip your Y and poof, your world works out fine. And yeah. I should also notice each of these also has something like, this operator typically cannot be done in place. Don't test me on this. I mean, you're welcome to. Okay? And I do have the word typically, and are there special ways to make it work? There are. And is that useful for space efficiency? Yes. It doesn't make your code horribly bloated and ugly. Absolutely, and don't try. Okay. Yeah.
Why does this shark have a reason book have a 1/16 in the front? The matrix has it to 0.
It does. But this, the matrix adds up to 0, but it isn't normalized in the sense that suppose I was doing this spot here, okay, and all of these pixels were black, but these ones weren't. I would have ended up with something more than 1, okay? So this is a normalizing factor such that I'm going to end up getting an approximation of the actual gradient, as opposed to some multiplier of the gradient. Now, can I get more than 1 out of this if I have my original image only in the 0, 1 space?
No.
No, right? And that's what we want, right? If we had a negative 1, 1 space, we could. But we can't. We only have a 0, 1 space. We're going to get between negative 1 and 1, and that is the factor that makes that do it. Other questions before we dive into the non-local? Yeah?
So if you apply the convolution filter more than once, then you'd have to figure out the negative 1 and 1, like normalizing thing, right?
Right. So if I were to try to apply the gradient of the gradient, the first gradient had a negative 1s available. And so then now I can no longer guarantee that I'm in the right space. And so I need a 1/32 for the next one if I want to keep it negative 1, 1 or something. Although the gradient of the gradient isn't something we usually think about for images. Although, you know, second derivatives do exist in the general world. Other questions? All right. We also have the non-local. And I realize that these are the cool ones. And people usually don't do them, and that makes me kind of sad. Flood isn't too cool. I mean, flood is, let's just talk about what flood does. Let's just look at the image. Right? Okay, what are we doing here? The idea is we pick a pixel, and we color all pixels that are connected to it by something that's not too different in color. So we pick something, I mean, this is not necessarily a super interesting one to pick, but we picked, I believe it was a fairly bright pixel. Maybe no, it's medium gray. And so we will say, and we see all the lighter grays that were too different from it and the blackish things that were too different from it, but it just sort of flows around. And the entire boundary of it is the lighter stuff. Okay, so everywhere it goes until it gets something too bright and then it stops. This is something that like every paint tool you've ever used has the bucket. This is a slightly cleverer version of the bucket. There are very efficient algorithms for this. Nobody ever writes them. I mean, unless they really, really care, because space just isn't what it used to be, and so it doesn't matter. Anyway, and so actually this image also has another one down at the bottom. We grabbed the palest thing because there's a little white spot there, and we painted that bright green, and so anyway, you can see what's going on there. And you can, it has an adjustable how much you're allowed to be off, and so on for different things. Path. I believe this is often an example used in algorithms classes. I have seen an example of this. Oh, only about a quarter of us. All right. We pick 2 points, and we want to find an energy minimizing connection. Okay? This is the concept. This is typically done with, there's different ways of doing this. But it's often used as an example of dynamic programming. Okay, and so if you pull up your algorithms textbook and look at the dynamic programming, they probably have the algorithm spelled out for you. But the basic idea is the more different a pixel, so this one actually asks you to stick with the highest gradient. So you find the gradient, and it costs more to cross low gradient magnitude than high gradient magnitude. So we'll tend to stick to edges of things. And you walk the path and find out where they go. Okay. And so we have exactly what that weighting factor is and how to find it. And dynamic programming will solve this. And you can outline things. And so this is commonly done as well. This is a particularly weird one. How did he make this picture? It's sort of smearing, but there's some crisp edges. And I didn't use a brush to do it. I didn't go in there by hand. This is all done automatically. So this idea is we're going to use that back advection thing we talked about for fluids. But we're not going to use a fluid flow. We're going to use some a 90 degree rotation of the gradient. So we're going to grab something perpendicular to the gradient and move it over. And so everything's sort of flow, swirl around the high gradients. I believe we did the 90 degrees here, yes? No, we just did the direct gradient. So yeah, we just grab from the gradient. We just pull from the gradient and we pull it in. And then I believe the input file for this, if memory serves, it does it twice, okay? So we do this a couple of times. We grab things that are along the gradient, we pull them in, and we figure out what's going on. There's some information about using a weighted average sampling. Pick the neighboring pixels, and you'll end up with a smoother picture. Anyway, this is the sort of thing that you're like, okay, I don't know why I would do that, but I can totally imagine playing around with my latest 2D graphics program and finding out that something does this. And this is often what happens is somebody figures that we could do something interesting, and then somebody says, oh, that looks sort of like, I don't know, you were looking at it through a wet windshield or something, I don't know, somebody will want that. And then it turns out somebody does, because once you give them tools, they find a way to use it. And then we have seam carving. I have had seam carving explained before. Oh, half of you. All right. So, does anybody want me to try to give a brief summary of how we get South America to run into Africa? Besides, you know, Pangaea. Yeah.
So we're doing the same thing we do with path, except it's from like the top to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to find the path that's like one pixel wide that has like the least difference.
Mm-hmm.
And they usually cut that out. And I think in this image you cut that out a lot.
I did. I did many, many of those. Right, so at any given point in time, we're going to try to find a particular kind of path. Let me just, for those of you that haven't seen it, let me just point out something. Okay, we're going to pick some pixel, we're going to start somewhere on the top. General seam carving, we don't decide where to start. We check every possible start position and find the one that's the cheapest. And then we're going to say, okay, I've got a starting position. I could go to 3 pixels from here. Which one's most like this pixel? And I'll decide, oh, that was most like this pixel. From there, I could go to 3 positions. Which one was most like this pixel? Maybe this one is most like this pixel. And we just keep going until we end up with this minimal path. Now, if we do this directly, the greedy way, it won't work very well. It'll chop the top well, but the bottom poorly. So what we actually want to know is not what is the cheapest next neighbor. We want to know if we're only allowed to either go straight or one diagonal all the way from the top to the bottom, what is the cheapest of all possible paths? So dynamic programming for the win, right? And so we do that, we find the cheapest path, the one with the least differences along it, and then we just delete all those pixels and smash the image one narrower, okay? And then you do it again on the new image. You can compute them all up front, but what this one does is make it shorter a bunch of times, make it narrower a bunch of times. And it will just sort of, every time it will remove stuff that didn't matter much. Okay? And so it'll end up in the, it works really well with the globe because oceans are blue. And it just removes the oceans, right? Just smashes all the land together. If you try it on TJ, it won't work quite as well. Okay? You'll end up like, you'll chop off his cravat, right? And sort of crop in on his face. And it'll work okay, but it isn't as interesting because there aren't things to move around as much. And then your definition of what's close matters a lot. And if you try it on the moon, it's just chaos, right? And so it can't do really cool things. So yeah, anyway. But that scene carving. So those are that's what we have. Questions on homework 5? Okay. And I realize I left only half of a lecture to talk about film, so let's talk about film. This is a little excerpt from an article that is really like a marketing pitch for a book. But I haven't read the book. It may be a great book. I don't know. It's linked from the schedule, so you're welcome to go look at it. And this is designed for animators. This is trying to point out what we do when we actually make a movie. And it leaves out so many steps. Anyway, but we'll talk about these steps. We'll talk about some others. Then we'll talk about why computing cares about any of these. And I kind of like how this is worded. It is important to keep in mind that unlike traditional 2D animation, which follows a fully established path, CG production is still in the midst of defining and standardizing its processes. I'm not sure it is standardizing its processes, but it is certainly true that it is not linear. Okay, 2D animation has this process of storyboarding and then making keyframes with the expensive artists and then giving them to the cheap artists to fill in, right? It has this system that it has a sequentiality and so on. 3D isn't like that. Depending on the style of the show, the software used, and actual production process is quite different. Here's a basic outline. Design, modeling, rigging, surfaces, texture and coloring, staging, workbook, animation, lighting, effects, rendering, composite, touch-up, final film, video output. However, we don't usually follow these in order. Most of these can be parallelized. So, most of these are also things we would do in art, not in computing. But almost all of them will want computer aid. And so there is software involved. Yeah, I think in all of this, in making this work, and some of it will start along the way. So it starts with people like sitting down and saying, here's our cool idea. What's a cool idea? Somebody give me a pitch.
Dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs. Give me something unrelated to dinosaurs. We'll make it into an interesting pitch.
The moon is actually like a huge spaceship.
That's a lot like, okay, all right. So we have dinosaurs, the moon is actually like a large spaceship. And it's actually moving really, really fast. We're only seeing it in rotoscope, and it's creating a time warp as general relativity applies. All right, great. So here's our plot. We're gonna go back in time by making the moon go really, really fast and only showing it every once in a while because quantum. Hooray. So here's our pitch. So what we're gonna do is start with the idea, and then we get people sit together and they're gonna say, all right, we need to storyboard this. Storyboarding is a process of basically sketching out pictures that you might try to put on the screen to tell the story. Because animation is fundamentally a visual medium. So knowing we have a good story doesn't mean we have a good story we can show. And so we're gonna start by, I don't know, I'm not good at storyboarding, but why not? Might as well give it a go. So we're gonna start by doing something like, so we're going to start with a big show of the moon. We have to make it a crescent because nobody will know it's a moon otherwise. And then from the moon, we're going to, I don't know, zoom in on the moon. We're gonna call zoom because I didn't draw that very well. And then from the zoom in on the moon, we're gonna see a crater. Let's write crater because I didn't know it was a crater. And then we're going to zoom in until we're really big inside the crater. We're gonna keep zooming. I don't know how to say that. And we're going to see, oh no, there's a dinosaur. Right? Okay, and so on. Or whatever it is, okay? Generally, artists and designers will go through many copies of this. They'll make many drafts. They'll often do them on individual pieces of paper and put them up on a big board and stand around and move them around and say, we can move this and what about this and sketch something new, right? It's a very interesting process. that, like, you know, two of the 15,000 people that work on any given movie get to do. So great, this happens. There is software to support this. There's lots of pieces of software I've seen. I have not yet seen signs that a software system here has succeeded. It turns out that people just like moving stuff and sketching things with pencils. So as far as I know, this stays mostly off. Although very often at some point somebody says, okay, we've got the storyboard, and then they come along with camera, snap, 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 and then they put it in something so they can show them one at a time and get a sense of timing and so on, right? All of that software is fairly simple. That happens before we get to design, okay? Once I've got that, I then need to decide, like, okay, I know I need a dinosaur. What should dinosaurs look like? Maybe we're going to try to make them cartoony with giant heads and tiny bodies, right? And maybe, no, we're going to try to make them look terrifying, even the herbivores, since we're going to make them all mean with lots of teeth and long, lumpy necks, because lumpy is scary, right? And so there'll be some design process where you'll try, concept art will come out of this, and somebody will say, well, that one's good, but I don't really know if it works, and so you'll get people to paint them up, and you'll get all that concept art that you find out about cool movies, right? And then all that has to be turned into stuff in your computer. Now, where do the computer scientists come into this? So far, this is all artists. The computer scientists come in when you have some model and it has something you don't know how to render, or you don't know how to animate. And you start thinking about, you said that this thing has a spring-shaped neck, and I need to decide what happens when it swallows. Okay? And so you'll have the technical people will take some little element they don't know how to do, and they will start year-long process of trying to find out how to do it. I don't know how often this happens, but I do know some examples. When Ratatouille was being planned, there was a group of people at Pixar that spent, I believe it was 2 years, trying to find a good way of rendering bread. And they succeeded, and their paper's quite interesting. Anyway, they had something called a multi-pole subsurface scattering approximation. And then, once you figure it out, you can almost always tell, for Pixar in particular, what their new technology was, because they use a lot of it in whatever short comes out with that movie. Does anybody remember what short came out with Ratatouille? It was the kid in his bed being pulled out the window by an alien spaceship and through a tree? Called Lifted, I believe. I wonder if we have a copy of that online. Let's find out. That's a great question. So if I find it, we're going to play it. And then you need to tell me, where did they use bread? Okay, let's jump forward into it a little bit. There's, of course, sound that's really important, but I'm not playing it. Oh, right, you probably want to be able to see more than a black screen, don't you? See anything that looks like bread yet? Right, and of course, the trick with shorts is you always have to get all of the laughs without, right, anyway. How do you make this work? They actually had the light shining through the wall too, so they could have the cloud in the wall. Anyway, right? Any bread yet? See, bread is like a giant thing of switches. All right, let me skim forward to where the bread starts mattering. Nope, I didn't skim forward far enough. It's part of the outside scene. Here we go. Ah. How do you make a tree? So they could have rendered every leaf. They totally didn't. They revealed this in their paper.
It's bread.
The leaf is just a lumpy blob. Has no internal geometry. And then they did the whole thing with their algorithm for bread, which is there are dense areas and not dense areas and light bounces through it. And this allows the air pockets in bread, and it allows the gaps between leaves and trees. And then you add just a couple tiny little triangles to float around, and oh, it's a leaf tree, okay? And so they had a way of doing this. They needed something to show it off with things that weren't bread, and so they made this movie, right? And it's, you know, not a bad show. So this is the sort of thing where the computer scientist comes into the picture fairly early on. So you have a character like Sully in Monsters, Inc., and you say, oh no, we have to actually figure out how to do fur. Or we have a character like Mrs. Incredible from The Incredibles, and we're like, how do we make something stretch around with no bones and still look interesting? Right? All of these things require either new technologies or tweaks to the technology or new user interfaces that start coming in early in the design process. And each one's a little different, and once you finish it, then everybody knows how you did it, and you can't make movie because you're unique in that space again. If you look at the history of CG movies, you'll notice that there is nobody does something, then there's a movie that does a lot of it, and then it's everywhere. Okay? And you will keep seeing that. There's also artists that actually create the models. Sometimes you have to create technology for that. Okay? Because sometimes the modeling process is complicated. Actually, Pixar started with a better way of making people using something called the Catmull-Clark subdivision surfaces, which were a new way of representing things like expressions and so on. Rigging, we've talked about this a little bit. This is where we said bones and how we attach them to all that. Coming up with the right rig is complicated, and this is sort of pseudo-programming. It is common for the rig to have little scripting elements about when you bend this, do all of this other complicated stuff, but we don't usually write that. That's usually the artists. Surfaces often require some new computation. If it's just, oh, we have a texture map, hooray. But very often there will be something in there where like, we're going to make a movie about clouds. We need to figure out how to draw clouds. We need to figure out not just how to draw clouds we create with a fluid simulation, but clouds that can be animated by an animator. What does that mean? How do we make a user interface to change how thick they are and poof around? Or we have lots of feathers. Oh, feathers, everybody knows like dark feathers have that opalescent sheen. How do we make opalescent sheen? Or whatever it is, right? And so a lot of the planning that the computer scientists do comes in early, and then the rest of it happens at the end. Okay? There's some that happens in the middle, but the big place we do it is effects. There are effect artists. Teams of people that spend years working on, let's get the hair of this one character correct. Okay? I have yet to meet a hair artist. I want to meet a CG hair artist someday. I've seen little clips of them. It seems like a fascinating job. Imagine spending your a year of your life full time working on the scene where Mrs. Incredible falls in the ocean and her hair gets wet and then she comes up and swishes it around, right? Anyway, and I know this exists because I saw an interview with this person once. Anyway, usually what happens is the effects have some amount of physics simulation and some amount of art direction. And that interaction is always awkward. Okay? Because physics and artists almost never agree on what the world should look like. And it is up to somebody else to decide how they interface. And so you will come along and they say, but the hair isn't springy enough, make it springier. And so you'll up the spring force console, and the hair will blee! And they're like, no, that was scary. Anyway. And there's a whole lot of iterating. Sometimes it's just little tweaking things, sometimes it's write a whole new tool chain to make this one scene work. And there are more than one interview and comment I've seen from people that basically say, I spent 2.5 years with a team of 10 people writing a piece of software that made 3 seconds of the movie and then we threw it away. And sometimes you do that. And that may hurt your soul if you like efficiency, but it may make your soul happy if you want to work in this space as a software engineer, right? The total number of these people, though, is like dwarfed by the animators and modelers. Look at the end credits of a movie sometime and count up how many people you could guess might have a CS degree. And it's usually, you know, in the 20 or 30 range if it's got quite a lot of CG. Out of the, let's say, 800 animators or something. but they have typically more stable positions as well. There's some that happens down at the end too. So very often, it's not, this actually more commonly in a live action film, we filmed it and now we want to add those special effects in. A lot of this is art, measuring the lighting correctly. Sometimes involves having to come up with a new lighting model to make that work. But a lot of it is, oh no, you can see that this actor said the wrong thing. How do we remove their, make their mouth look like they said the right thing without paying them to come back out and film them again? Right? Particularly if they said the wrong thing as they were jumping through a plate glass window or right something that's really expensive to shoot again. And so there's all kinds of post-processing that happens here that involves a lot of the sort of things we're talking about for homework 5, though way more complicated. So let's just give an example. Let's consider the path. If I want to make it look like TJ is talking, I need to figure out how to move TJ's mouth, which means I need to know what TJ's mouth is. So one approach, there are lots of other approaches we use, but we would do something like, we would sort of find the outlines of different parts of the path of the mouth. We would make some weighting function so that after we find one, the next one isn't allowed to go very close to it, so we can sort of find, sort of mesh this region of the model. Okay, and then we're going to use some sort of weighting system to allow it to move apart, and then somebody's going to have to tell us what to put when we open it, what goes inside, right? And so we can create some sort of 2D bone skin system with twists and weights that we need to add to this. And finding gradients and maximal gradients and so on is often a piece of this. If I only want this one scene, it'll be a lot cheaper to just give the artist the ability to define regions and move them. But if I want to do this many times, it'll start becoming efficient to create software to make this effective. A lot of the we sit down and think carefully about it approach is starting to, or mostly at this point, I guess, been replaced by we throw hundreds of thousands of hours of video at a neural network and we hope it does the right thing. And it seems to be working pretty well. It has some weird moments, but it also seems to work pretty well. So there's a whole space there, and that's a growing space. So if you're interested in machine learning and graphics, there's a huge space because there's money here. Movies and make money. Animation makes money. And so there's room to be in this space if you want to. Machine learning is not my forte, so I'm not going to be able to give you a whole lot of pointers on that, though. Yeah. So where were we? OK. There's a lot of pieces we've left out here, but, and we'll get to some of those in a moment. Any questions about any of these ideas we've summarized at a high level so far? All right. There's another piece of film, and actually some portions of video games nowadays, that we haven't really mentioned much at all and isn't mentioned here. So let's talk about it now. Let's call this graphics backwards. This is not a formal name for it. If we want to run graphics backwards, what would be the input? What would be the output? Input a picture, output camera position, and model, and velocity, and so on. Okay. Now in robotics, this is called, the most common version of this is called SLAM, simultaneous location and mapping. And that's its own complicated space, but often assumes the world is static. For movies, the reason we care about this is because we hire actors and then we replace them with digital models. This has turned out to be more effective for humanoid-ish things than paying animators for many different reasons. And so we have some actual physical person that is running around doing whatever it is they're doing in their mocap suit. And we'll talk about why there's a mocap suit in here in a moment. Okay. So they'll be running around doing whatever action we ask them to do, okay? And so we'll end up getting whatever they did, and we want to turn their motion into bones and positions of bones and information about their facial expressions and so on. Give me some ideas about how we could go about doing this. Yeah.
Two cameras.
I could have two cameras. Why two?
You want depth from different perspectives.
Parallax. Okay. I want to know where things are from different perspectives, figure out where they are. Triangulation is the core idea here. The trick with this, the hard part of this is, what would be the hardest piece? If you were to try ask to do this, what would you get stumped on? Yes?
What if the cameras are inaccurate?
The cameras are inaccurate. It turns out we can fix this. We can post-process change where the pixels were.
Having the characters or actors interact with virtual objects?
This, it turns out, objects is a little bit tricky because you have to add a new model, but it's not the hardest part.
Synchronizing
cameras? Nope, we're pretty good at timing.
It's really, 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 really hard to perfectly calculate the alignment of the cameras with respect to each other.
So we can actually do that based on the camera. You're right, this used to be a hard problem. We figured out how to do this based on the film itself to figure out where the cameras were. Who knew, right?
It's hard to be able to capture all aspects of the mocap suit, because maybe the actual twist away, it's not in the view of either of the cameras.
So maybe they go out of camera, we just buy more cameras. Cameras are cheap. See, this is the problem that only, let me pause and editorialize. This is why it's hard to be a software engineer. Normal people, even software engineers in other disciplines, don't understand what's hard and what's easy. Okay? These all seem like things that would be hard, and some of them, admittedly, used to be hard and we've solved. Some of them never actually were hard once you try doing them. The hard thing is to know that that point on their face was that point on their face in both cameras. This is the part that makes this really, really hard. This is the reason that motion capture suits will have long strips of Velcro and you'll put something white and reflective on it. But that will then jiggle around and it's touching Velcro and it's not minuscule and you'll see different parts of it, and so you try to do some sort of average there. Or you throw it at some sort of feature detection algorithm and hope they find similar features. They never find exactly the same ones. We'll often find very similar ones. You mash them up. You don't really know what they represented. But this is the part that we spend, the computational effort spends so much of its time trying to figure out what the features are and how they match up. Yeah?
Could you fix that by just having slightly more expensive motion capture inputs, that kind of track their own position?
So you mean I have the motion capture input itself tell me where it is?
Yes.
How does it know where it is?
Accelerometers and then...
Yeah, accelerometers. I don't know if you ever tried dead reckoning with accelerometers. This is a random aside. My first semester teaching at UVA, I was teaching 2110 back in the day when we had an Android project as part of 2110. And I had this great idea that we were going to use the accelerometers in all of our Android tablets to use them as part of a little game people would make. And we found out that the accelerometers had so much drift that you could, by the time the game finished booting up, it would think you had moved 10 feet across the room or something. Anyway, now you can get high quality accelerometers and so on, but they're expensive and they're big and they take energy, and that means you can't put a whole lot of them on somebody, which means you get a very low res information about them. Right? We can have somebody sit down and we're going to paint on your face some retroreflective dots. And then we're going to shine a bright light at you and see what shines. But then you have to pay the actor to sit there and they have to not sweat. Yeah?
There's also some really good research into this. It's pretty new about using targets to represent moiré patterns to determine orientation purely based on the image.
Yes. So there's these weird patterns where you shine strange light on them that will create a secondary pattern on top of them and then detect the change in the secondary pattern. And there's various versions of this. And this works all right, but it tends to make the actors a little weirded out. So then maybe we're going to do it in the infrared, right? Or anyway, there's so this is a space where there's a huge amount of research in the computing space. There's some in the engineering space of how we make the environments to do this. There was actually an early system where they said, we're going to put little things on them that make noises at different frequencies, little sound emitters, and put a microphone in each corner of the room and use the speed of sound to figure out where they were. And this actually worked pretty well until they stepped, right? We've been working on this for a long time, and I don't foresee the day that we'll call it a solved problem. We're getting pretty good, But we still end up getting a fair amount of error here. And then the other piece of this is, given you have some error, you have noisy data about where these points were, how do you remove that noise to get back a nice, clean model of how somebody was behaving? Question?
Could you just use the technology that VR uses, like, to remember where your headset is when you walk
around? Sure. How small is that? How many of those can you use? And it turns out VR almost only cares about orientation. Orientation is way easier than position. And basically the reason for that is gravity. So if you try to measure something moving without a reference, it appears to be rocketing up into the sky because there's this huge acceleration that it's not going down. Right? 9.8 meters per second, it's just accelerating, shooting upwards, and that's what you get out of your accelerometers. And you have to say, let's remove that, and by the time you remove that, all the stuff you actually do is like noise, right? So position is really hard based on acceleration because of gravity. Whereas orientation, I don't care about that. We make a few gyroscopes, and we can get it with high degree of accuracy. But we do need gyroscopes, things physically spinning around, and then something to measure them, so they can't be that small. We're getting gyroscopes smaller over time, but they still tend to be a little bit big. Incidentally, your phone, how does it know orientation? It says, well, gravity's pulling one direction, and your magnet's pointing another, and that gives me a coordinate system. It gives you a very inaccurate coordinate system, but that's nonetheless what it does. So, this is a huge piece. Okay? And it doesn't stop here. Once I have an actual human doing something, I then need to retarget this to say, oh, but I was supposed to do some sort of furry monster with a giant head and long spindly arms and a short little body, or whatever it was I was supposed to do. Okay? And how do I make this thing do what I wanted it to do? Okay? Because if all I wanted was a human, sometimes that's what we do in video games. Sometimes we'll actually hire motion capture actors that have a similar body type to the character they want to put in the film, or in the game. And so in the game space, you don't have a whole lot of this to worry about. Until you get to the bad guys, and then you often have them doing some, you know, our weird squid things that we just do programmatically instead anyway. But if we want to make something that's pseudo-humanoid but differently built, then we have to figure out how do we turn this motion into that without it looking strange. Because we'll have built into this all of the constraints about what's easy and hard, where the energy goes. In general, humans act in a fairly low energy way, and muscles have springs. Okay? And so, it'll be easier to straighten your leg if it was straight a moment ago and just recently bent, because you can use the spring force in your muscles to push you up. There's all kinds of these things that are baked into the physiology of the actor. We repurpose those, or some things are long and some things are short, and the whole thing got to be heavier, and the physics is off. And they're walking around as if they, like, all of their weight is in their knees or something, and they will look off balanced and awkward. And so there's this whole space of how do I repurpose motion and then fix it to be physiologically accurate. And so there's actually this space where you take an animated person and you say, I want to measure the energy, the work they would have had to do this action if they were a real person. And then I want to try to minimize that within some constraints about don't get too far from the original. There's actually this process where after you repurpose it, then you come along and you say, okay, let's make some physics, and then we'll make it easier, and then we'll put it back on the model, okay, in order to make the model look a little bit better, okay? And all of these pieces are like purely CS, more CS plus other technical fields, right, that the artist doesn't even know happened in general. And so there's quite a bit here that goes on. And we also do this for faces. How to repurpose an expression? How to repurpose all these kinds of things? How do we measure them to create these libraries? So there's a lot of this that goes on. And a lot of this you won't see at all on the credits of a movie. Because often this is just, we use software. Who wrote the software? Somebody else, right? Some company somewhere. I don't know who they were. We just rented it, right? And so it's harder to get a good read on where they are because they don't show us their credits. But there's quite a bit of this that goes on to making movies. Thoughts, comments, questions about this so far before we get to another kind of graphics backwards? Okay. What does upholstery look like? We talked a little bit about this when we were talking about BRDFs. Let's come back and look at it again. Let's look for, not that, an image of upholstery. This will be a fine picture here. Let's think about just, I've actually sat on this mine was red. Anyway, I was visiting somebody's house and they had this sofa. How weird. Anyway, all right. There are so many strange things happening. The geometry here is simple. We have a little bit of lumpy stuff, but this will not be hard to model. The animation is even easier. There isn't any, right? And yet this is going to be a really hard thing to simulate. Let's consider, for example, this pillow. Okay? We have several copies of this pillow. Are the big swoops a different color than the little gloopy things? Yes, I think they're actually different color, physically different color. No, I think they're the same. All right, we about 3/4 think they're the same, 1/4 think they're different color. If we can't decide, this suggests we already have a problem in knowing how to model it. Right? Because we have these really complicated bidirectional refractance functions. We don't, in general, have very much subsurface scattering. We don't have much reflection and so on. We just have this problem that the shininess depends on angle in strange ways. Look at this corner of the sofa over here. What is happening? Why is there this whitish spot with black dots? And a better question, I'm guessing, why did most of you not initially say, somebody slapped a little imitation cowhide on the side of the sofa? Right? Your eye just says, okay, it's a sofa, and you probably get a sense of what it feels like from that picture. Because your brain is used to this extremely complicated input data that's based on, in principle, what's actually happening here is we have shiny velvet. We have lots of tiny little hairs that individually have a high specularity that may also be fuzzy and have secondary hair notion in the opposite direction that's also shiny, that are moving, mostly pointing the same direction, but not all of them because they got bumped. That's basically what's happening here. It is possible to simulate that, but we probably didn't want to allocate several billion triangles to this sofa, right? And if we don't want to allocate billions of triangles to the sofa, we can't do the velvet literally, so we have to come up with an approximation of the velvet. And so there are a handful of like high hand-wavy kinds of things, and we can do things like this pillow, the shinier pillows, pretty well. Even these are fairly complicated. You notice the shine is not uniform and so on. But we can do this pretty well with an approximation algorithm. Or we can buy a sofa and put it in a completely black room with one light we control and one camera we control and take a whole lot of pictures. Okay? And if we do this, we can measure many, 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 many views of the sofa, and then we can have this giant set. Now, how many pictures do I have to have before I have the full BRDF? Sure. Let's suppose I have some satisfactory, how many dimensions of pictures do I need? Let's remind ourselves what the BRDF, what does it depend on? I know this is going back a while. Anybody remember what the inputs of the BRDF are? Okay, so we have information about the light color and brightness. We have a normal.
Direction to the camera, direction to...
Direction to the camera, direction to the eye. Okay, now the BR part, the B part, the bidirectional part, means there's some things we don't need. So we would expect this to be, well, In reality, this is an analog single dimension because every wavelength behaves differently on some materials. But for upholstery, we can often treat this as just being three axes, red, green, and blue. And sometimes we can treat it as just one. The normal would in general be three, except we normalize it, so it's really just two. Okay? The camera and the eye, each, again, they have three, but they're really just two because we can normalize them. It doesn't matter if you're farther away. Okay? So this would end up with two, four, six, between six and nine dimensions. Between six and eight dimensions, I guess. We don't need all of these, though, because there's this magic characteristic that if you swap the camera and eye's position, nothing changes. And that saves us another dimension. Okay? And because our camera takes all of these at once, okay? And we actually only care about the relative orientation of the camera and the eye to the normal, all at once. Because cameras, right? We've gotten pretty good color cameras these days. Okay? So what we really need to know, if we imagine this is the normal, we need to know two angles off of the normal, one for the light, one for camera. We don't care which one is which. So that cuts our sample space in half. And then we also have to care about their sort of their around the normal angle of both. Okay, and again, we don't care which one of those is which. So you end up having just four angles that we care about. But that's still four dimensions of pictures that we would need to take at a fairly dense sampling to actually know what the BRDF is. We actually used to have faculty here that we had a whole gantry where they would set up this thing with cameras and lights in a dark room and take pictures of objects and measure these things and wrote many papers about better ways of making this efficient. Said faculty member now works for, Adobe, I believe. Yes? I mean, if I have one picture, how much more information did I need? So let's think about what one dimension of pictures would mean. Let's suppose here is my object, and I could take a picture from over here, and a picture from down in front of it, and a picture sort of from all directions around it in a big circle. That would be one dimension. Okay? And then I would also want to go around it in this direction for every one of those. That would be my second dimension. And then I'll need to do the same thing for the light for every one of these camera positions, giving me two more dimensions. Yes?
Do they do this with like video rigs at all? Can they just like take a video and move the light around?
Right, so we can take the pictures very quickly. It turns out we don't want to actually use film because film involves compression that will lose the stuff we're trying to capture. Because it will do a temporal compression. So we actually want to save every image individually, and this is something they're working on. Is there a better way of storing the similarity without losing the temporal component that you actually cared about? But yeah, we can just move it around, but we still have to move around the camera and the lights, okay, a dense sampling of two-dimensional spaces. And that's still a lot of time. And it's a lot of data. And then you have to try to compress that data in a way you can actually represent inside of your rendering algorithm so that your BRDF isn't gargantuanly big. And then when you do this with a real object, unless it's of uniform material, we need more than that because we also need to know what part of the material had each of these pieces. So we also have to identify features and line them up and figure out what this was touching. Because if we do this pillow, we can sort of eyeball it and say there's three or four main textures going on, right? We have this texture, maybe that's a different texture, maybe not. We seem to disagree. We have the white stuff and we have the fringe. And so we need to figure out what the normal of those is, which you don't in general know. And so there's this sort of reverse engineering, find out what the normal was and how many textures were they, and can we compress them down to something we can represent? And so this is the sort of thing that goes on that computer scientists do primarily in the film industry. A lot of it is completely invisible. There are the cool things about let's make bread and we can also make somebody pop through a tree. But there's a whole lot more of this, I want to know where somebody was standing. which is a technically interesting question, even if it isn't an artistically interesting question. And that's my little spiel about computing in the film industry. I had more, but you know, we talked about homework 5. So, that's what we got. I will see you all on Tuesday.